freely depicted in his own vocation, gentlemen, the Canaller would make a fine dramatic hero, so abundantly and picturesquely wicked is he. Like Mark Antony, for days and days along his green-turfed, flowery Nile, he indolently floats, openly toying with his red-cheeked Cleopatra, ripening his apricot thigh upon the sunny deck. But ashore all this effeminacy is dashed. The brigandish guise which the Canaller so proudly sports, his slouched and gaily ribboned hat betoken his grand features. A terror to the smiling innocence of the villages through which he floats, his swart visage and bold swagger are not unshunned in cities. Once a vagabond on his own canal, I have received good turns from one of these Canallers. I thank him heartily, would fain be not ungrateful. But it is often one of the prime redeeming qualities of your man of violence that at times he has as stiff an arm to back a poor stranger in a strait as to plunder a wealthy one. In some, gentlemen, what the wildness of this canal life is emphatically evinced by this, that our wild whale fishery contains so many of its most finished graduates, and that scarce any race of mankind except Sydney men are so much distrusted by our whaling captains. Nor does it at all diminish the curiousness of this matter that to many thousands of our rural boys and young men born along its line, the probationary life of the Grand Canal furnishes the sole transition between quietly reaping in a Christian cornfield and recklessly ploughing the waters of the most barbaric seas. I see, impetuously exclaimed Don Pedro, spilling his chicha upon his silvery ruffles. No need to travel. The world's one lima. I had thought now that at your temperate north their generations were cold and holy as the hills. But the story. I left off, gentlemen, where the lakeman shook the backstay. Hardly had he done so when he was surrounded by the three junior mates and the four harpooners who all crowded him to the deck. But sliding down the ropes like baleful comets, the two canallers rushed into the uproar and sought to drag their man out of it towards the forecastle. Others of the sailors joined with them in this attempt, and a twisted turmoil ensued. While standing out of harm's way, the valiant captain danced up and down with a whale pike, calling upon his officers to manhandle that atrocious scoundrel and smoke him along to the quarter-deck. At intervals he ran close up to the revolving border of the confusion, and prying into the heart of it with his pike, sought to prick out the object of his resentment. But Steelkilt and his desperadoes were too much for them all. They succeeded in gaining the forecastle deck, where, hastily slewing about three or four large casks in a line with the windlass, these sea Parisians entrenched themselves behind the barricade. "Come out of that, ye pirates!" roared the captain, now menacing them with a pistol in each hand, just brought to him by the steward. "Come out of that, ye cutthroats!" Steelkilt leaped on the barricade, and striding up and down there, defied the worst the pistols could do, but gave the captain to understand distinctly that his, Steelkilt's, death would be the signal for a murderous mutiny on the part of all hands. Fearing in his heart lest this might prove but too true, the captain a little desisted, but still commanded the insurgents instantly to return to their duty. "Will you promise not to touch us if we do?" demanded their ringleader. Turn to, I make no promise. To your duty. Do you want to sink the ship by knocking off at a time like this? Turn to!" And he once more raised a pistol. "Sink the ship?" cried Steelkilt. "Aye, let her sink. Not a man of us turns to unless you swear not to raise a rope yarn against us. What say ye, men?" turning to his comrades. A fierce cheer was their response. The lakeman now patrolled the barricade, all the while keeping his eye on the captain and jerking out such sentences as these. "It's not our fault. We didn't want it. I told him to take his hammer away. It was boy's business. He might have known me before this. I told him not to prick the buffalo. I believe I've broken a finger here against this cursed jaw. Ain't those mincing knives down in the forecastle there, men? Look to those hand-spikes, my hearties. Captain, by God, look to yourself. Say the word. Don't be a fool. Forget it all. We're ready to turn to. Treat us decently, and we're your men. But we won't be flogged." "Turn to. I make no promises. Turn to, I say." "Look ye now," cried the lakeman, flinging out his arm towards him. "There are a few of us here, and I am one of them who have shipped for the cruise, do you see? Now, as you well know, sir, we can claim our discharge as soon as the anchor is down. So we don't want a row. It's not in our interest. We want to be peaceable. We are ready to work, but we won't be flogged." "Turn to!" roared the captain. Steelkilt glanced round him a moment and then said, "I tell you what it is now, captain. Rather than kill you and be hung for such a shabby rascal, we won't lift a hand against you unless you attack us. But till you say the word about not flogging us, we don't do a hand's turn. Down into the forecastle, then. Down with you. I'll keep you there till you're sick of it. Down you go. Shall we? Cried the ringleader to his men. Most of them were against it, but at length, in obedience to Steelkilt, they preceded him down into their dark den, growlingly disappearing like bears into a cave. As the lakeman's bare head was just level with the planks, the captain and his posse leaped the barricade and, rapidly drawing over the slide of the scuttle, planted their group of hands upon it and loudly called for the steward to bring the heavy brass padlock belonging to the companionway. Then, opening the slide a little, the captain whispered something down the crack, closed it, and turned the key upon them, 10 in number, leaving on deck some 20 or more who thus far had remained neutral. All night, a wide-awake watch was kept by all the officers, forward and aft, especially about the forecastle scuttle and fore hatchway, at which last place it was feared the insurgents might emerge after breaking through the bulkhead below. But the hours of darkness passed in peace. The men who still remained at their duty, toiling hard at the pumps, whose clinking and clanking at intervals through the dreary night dismally resounded through the ship. At sunrise, the captain went forward and, knocking on the deck, summoned the prisoners to work, but with a yell they refused. Water was then lowered down to them, and a couple of handfuls of biscuit were tossed after it. When again turning the key upon them and pocketing it, the captain returned to the quarterdeck. Twice every day, for 3 days, this was repeated. But on the fourth morning a confused wrangling and then a scuffling was heard as the customary summons was delivered, and suddenly 4 men burst up from the forecastle saying they were ready to turn to. The fetid closeness of the air and a famishing diet, united perhaps to some fears of ultimate retribution, had constrained them to surrender at discretion. Emboldened by this, the captain reiterated his demand to the rest, but Steelkilt shouted up to him a terrific hint to stop his babbling and betake himself where he belonged. On the fifth morning, 3 others of the mutineers bolted up into the air from the desperate arms below that sought to restrain them. Only 3 were left. "Better turn to now," said the captain with a heartless jeer. "Shut us up again, will you?" cried Steelkilt. "Oh, certainly," said the captain, and the key clicked.
This ends Disc 8.